Of my talk is No Conservatism Without Republicanism. Members and guests of the Philadelphia Society, I'm honored to make my first appearance at one of your events alongside my friend Arthur Millick. And he and I share an important bond in that our youngest children were born 2 months ago within 24 hours of each other at the same hospital in Naples, Florida. So this is it's auspicious. More than that, I suspect the two of us are likely going to agree more than we disagree. I know this makes for a less exciting debate than if we were throwing chairs at each other. However, rather than booking a contest between American Affairs and Reason magazine, the debate here is going to be more American mind versus law and liberty. Moreover, as Liberty Fund aligned authors go, I'm probably the least classical liberal of the bunch. Indeed, I'm not really much of a classical liberal at all. I see myself more as a Catholic Republican. That I'm both Catholic and Republican informs why I'm not a liberal in any sense of that term, and not entirely hostile to federal intervention in certain aspects of private lives of citizens. The Catholic component, politically speaking, matters in that I place an emphasis on the common good as something to pursue prior to any particular group or citizen. Now, I'm not what some call a common good conservative, as common good conservatives have very expansive view of the common good, and hence what governments may do to suppress individual liberty. In other words, common good conservatives are either implicitly or explicitly authoritarian. I am a Republican, little r, meaning that I see as essential to the common good the individual pursuit of personal callings in life. And to serve the common good, government must preserve this liberty, but also the rule of law to ensure that the citizens use this liberty responsibly, as every liberty naturally entails a duty. So this example would be placing constraints or pursuing pornographic producers and distributors. For example, the liberty to speak entails the duty to speak well and avoid obscenity and forms of licentious speech. And the trouble with regulating this kind of speech is where to draw the line, of course, but such is the role of political liberty in settling these matters. Let the people vote and their representatives decide. All of this is merely to let you know where I stand. I know you didn't come here to this panel to hear me talk about myself. Rather, you want to hear where I stand on whether our institutions can be saved and how we might use state power to achieve our conservative ends. Can our institutions be saved? Saved from what? The answer's us, ourselves. Most of our political institutions operate or could operate normally. We need what needs saving are our historical institutions of self-government, having been neglected in favor of new ones based in short-term notoriety or authoritarian regulation. Should we use state power to pursue conservative ends? Of course. However, the state power we use is the kind that we find in constitutional Republican government rather than in the administrative state. Let me speak to both of these answers in turn. As for institutions of self-government, Yuval Levin has already made much of the problem that our Congress has failed because Congress wanted to fail. Both in his 2018 Commentary magazine and later his 2020 essay and his 2020 book, A Time to Build, Levin admits his arguments are a synthesis of years of political science scholarship. In fact, if you go back all the way to 1989, you can read Morris P. Fiorina's The Rise of the Washington Establishment, where he makes the same case. Though 33 years apart, Fiorina and Levin reach the same conclusion. It is simply easier for a member of Congress to conduct constituent services or appear in a cable news program than to pursue legislation even on the so-called 70-30 issues in which 70% of the constituents in that district or state prefer the legislation. The reasons are straightforward. Legislating requires a lot of hard work, potentially alienates constituents, and angling to shepherd the bill through Congress, all to either have it shut down in committee or perhaps worse, in a pass with the president or the governor taking all the credit, but the representative experiencing all the fallout in the district over the consequences. What is it in it for a member of Congress to do business of Congress? Historically, the answer, and here I'm going to just mention that I'm very unhappy with Joseph Postel, because we just had this conversation, and now I'm going to do it, but it's all I got, guys, so this is what we'll have. Historically, the answer has been political parties. Which assisted members of Congress in doing their job. Parties, as the saying as the saying goes, or the Madisonian's remedy to a Madisonian disease, of coordinating members of Congress to form energetic coalitions to serve at least portions of the public interest. In my view, the real institutions that need revitalization are the political parties, and the reason is that their proper form they provided was a forum for settling on a platform of issues, vetting quality candidates, and organizing fundraising for elections. Parties simply do not do this work anymore. The significant problem with restoring parties is existing federal policy, such as the 1971 Federal Elections Commission Act, the 2002 Bipartisan Campaign for Reform Act, and the 2010 Citizens United, and the two examples of FECA and BCRA, you always have to wonder if you can trust members of Congress to legislate on their own interests here. It doesn't seem so. So as James W. Caesar demonstrated in his landmark 1979 book, Presidential Selection Theory and Development, one of the unsung heroes of American constitutional republican is Martin Van Buren. Yes, Martin Van Buren, right? And I know many of you are excited that this talk has now taken the direction of talking about Martin Van Buren. So the thing about Van Buren is he in the 1830s, he developed the modern Democratic Party in both an effort to provide longevity to the party after Andrew Jackson's departure, as well as to provide an internal check on Jackson's own often very expansive view of his political power. The Van Buren Democratic Party was decentralized, with localities selecting delegates to attend state conventions to settle on state and local candidates, as well as to settle on state delegates to the National Convention to hammer out federal candidates and national platform. This platform was binding on party members who had to define themselves by it or campaign hard to change it. Much of this occurred in the figurative and often literal bare-knuckle fights among delegates, often settled in the proverbial smoke-filled rooms. And I didn't have time to make my make smoke-filled rooms great again hats, but I'll send the website when it's up. Woodrow Wilson and other progressive reformers reimagined political parties as divided between party faithful and party spokesmen. The latter would impose ideological discipline on the faithful, and the American people, shorn of participation in parties themselves, would make informed decisions about ideological position and leader they preferred in the primary elections and then later in the general election. Absolutely drained from party politics was the old idea of political association and self-government that Wilson believed provided the backdoor for private corporate interests and backroom deals, as he campaigns and president to say. Certainly, these were an issue, but a century out from those reforms, we still have the same private corporate interests and backroom deals with none of the liberty of association and self-government. Without association and self-government, the fuel that powered the legislative machine ran out, and parts stripped from the machine continue to flail about on the landscape. Efforts to carefully manage state parties have excluded populists on both sides who run insurgent nomination battles with candidates long on wind and short on every necessary skill for representative government. As the years pass, skilled legislators enter their golden years on K Street, leaving the novices to beg interest groups for legislative language for bills they don't know how to pass. Sometimes these insurgents seize the party from its managers, as in Arizona, with predictably dubious results for all involved. Party reform is harder to introduce with all the federal legislation interfering with its association, as I mentioned before, but the parties are easily the best place to start, as for conservatives it would be the tremendous advantage over a deeply fragmented Democratic Party, which is sustained primarily through white-collar woke patronage, as we heard before, and a bottomless hatred for everyone that aren't them. Parties provide conservatives with the opportunity to be emphatically for something and state the something on the basis of a decentralized process of legitimate consensus formation. America used to hold many such meetings like these that Alexis de Tocqueville humorously tells of an encounter in Democracy in America, in which a man starts to speak to him as though he were addressing an audience, despite Tocqueville being the only person in the conversation. It is precisely this we must restore, and the restoration of the other institutions like Congress becomes more possible, or we will not see a restoration of any institutions until we restore the parties to their original role. This leaves the second question, whether we should use the administrative state to serve conservative ends. The answer to this is no. By nature, the administrative state is authoritarian. It relies on delegated congressional powers, insulation from executive oversight, while wielding rulemaking, enforcing, and adjudicating powers all on its own. The combination of legislative, executive, and judicial powers is, as Publius illustrated in Federalist 51, by definition tyrannical, meaning they possess all the powers of government without accountability. Yet I said the administrative state is authoritarian, and this term has a modern vintage post-dating the Constitution's ratification debate. And I use this term because the authoritarian nature of the administrative state comes from its importation from an intentionally authoritarian government of the Second German Reich. American conservatives normally defend constitutional republican government, which means they cannot, by definition, support the modern administrative state. And those conservatives like Adrian Vermeul, who seek to integrate the administrative state from within with conservatives, have made clear that they are neither fond of the Constitution nor republican government. Moreover, conservatives have already tried this. The long conservative lament over the Chevron deference to administrative agencies has its origin in an even older conservative lament of activist federal courts in the hope of conservative presidents and their oversight of the executive. As Thomas Merrill has recently argued in his book, The Chevron Doctrine, conservatives like Antonin Scalia wanted Chevron deference to free up federal agencies from progressive judicial interference. With conservative presidents supervising these agencies, the hope was the result would be more conservative administrative state. The real result was progressive administrative authoritarianism. What progressive judges sold at retail, the progressive administrative state has sold at wholesale. Because the entire basis for the administrative state relies on progressive theory as promulgated in progressive universities for progressive ends. There can be no repurposing of these institutions for conservative ends unless one wants an authoritarian conservatism like that of Francisco Franco, which conserved in the end nothing but the extreme antipathy of the Spanish left. Does this mean that conservatives ought not to use political power to serve their ends at all? Of course not. The proper institutions already exist for conservatives to serve the public interest. These are the constitutional bodies of Congress and the presidency, as well as legislative and executive bodies in the states. And even in many cases, the elected judiciary of those states as well. State capitals are not as exciting as Washington, D.C., although, and given today's pleasant weather, this line doesn't land, but I'm going to say it anyway, although many have better climates. So if we had been here like a month ago, but anyway. And as I say this, I'm going to go down to South Florida where we're going to get hit by a hurricane. I shouldn't have said it. I should have, you know. But they also represent a market opportunity for conservatives to mobilize state parties along the decentralized approach I recommended earlier. That way, the online conservative street fights on things like Twitter and Facebook can be housed in actual meetings that have actual votes and settle on platforms with actual delegates. The urgency of party reform is already obvious, as Democrats have proved more than willing to interfere in state primaries by funding weak Republicans when the Democratic candidates themselves have nothing to offer the people in their states and districts. This project requires a great deal of time and effort, and therefore it poses a problem, allowing existing problems, like those actually mentioned by my friend Arthur, of getting worse, while there is only a chance in the medium term they might get better. To alleviate this problem, let me recommend the short-term solution promoted by Professor Dave DeVell, a professor of political science at the University of St. Thomas, Houston. He has a piece called, If You Can't Drain It, Staff It, Republicans in the Administrative Swamp. It's a great title. And he recommends conservatives should make sure that they are paying attention to this continuous task, finding people who will fill the administrative and bureaucratic roles that really make a difference. This does not have to be exclusive to the task of politicians or party. Think of the Federalist Society's role in providing judicial candidates for Republicans, but for administrators. Is this not for Mule's program? Did I not just call his program inherently authoritarian? Do I contradict myself in recommending this solution? I do not. First, DeVell recommends that this as a short-term solution himself. He ends his essay, should we drain the swamp? Absolutely. Just like the framers farmers who drained them in order to make the land more productive. But just as natural swamps can also serve the purpose of providing nourishment for other species, when we can't drain the administrative one, let's make sure that it feeds and does not feed off the nation politically. The purpose of conservative administrators would be to stop administrative overreach and wind down the institutions, and it is precisely here that parties become necessary. administrators tend to become attached to their jobs once they have them, and the parties, through elected officials, must impose discipline, even on conservative administrators to step down and provide them career opportunities. I mean, we're talking like the patronage stuff before. There needs to be an incentive to leave. The alternative is placing the Constitution and with it our republic at peril. It is not a perfect solution, but it may be a calculated risk worth taking to once again have a res publica, a thing of the people, and no longer a plaything of elites. And so I actually went under time. Thank you very much.